I'm talking to Dr. Audrey Quinn, consultant anaesthetist at Leeds General Infirmary and lead author on this paper. Dr. Quinn, welcome to the BJ podcast and thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's my pleasure to be here.
So if I could begin by asking you why the failed intubation rate is so much higher in the obstetric population, often quoted as being up to 10 times greater.
Yes, Rick, it's a very good question to start with, and it's something we do ask ourselves a lot. Why is it so much more? And it's obviously going to be something to do with the anatomy and physiology of the pregnant woman. And it's something you learn very early on in your career as an anaesthetist. You know about vascular engorgement and the difficulty with the breast getting in the way. You're dealing with a young population with lots of teeth, the aspiration risks, and the probable anxiety levels of anaesthetists when they're performing a direct laryngoscopy in someone who's usually presenting in an emergency situation. So lots and lots of factors, and some probably also to do with the fact we don't do very many of them anymore, and it's often out of hours that they occur.
After NAP4, my perception is that we're now pretty flush with airway incident data. What particular gap was this survey designed to fill?
Well, in fact, this survey started in 2008, Rick, and finished in 2010. So we were actually ahead of the game in NAP4, and I was delighted to be invited to be on the advisory group as the OAA rep, because it was a great opportunity for me to see two national audits or surveys, as it were, working in tandem. And actually, the NAP4 did ask different questions. They were looking for failed airways and harm caused by difficult airways. We were looking for failed intubations, and so it was quite different because obviously we were going to get a lot more in our study because the patients didn't all die or have tracheostomies or end up in ITU, which was the criteria for NAP4. So there were two different studies and looking at similar area, but actually looking at different things. We have learned a lot from both, which is complementary. We only had a small number from NAP4. We only had four cases, which we felt really was underreported. So the UCOS is much more of a complete and accurate picture of what's happening in the UK.
For those people who don't have a regular obstetric practice, could you explain a little more about how you collected the data and about UCOS?
Certainly. It's something that's been around for a long time. In fact, it's a group that started in Oxford. It was called NPEW. And they discovered Reye's syndrome in children several decades ago. And they're looking at rare disorders. And they started in paediatrics and neonatology and then moved on to obstetrics and have looked at things like peripartum hysterectomies, malaria, eclamptic fits, and more recently they've looked at myocardial infarction and cardiac arrest in pregnancy. And it's a system which relies on reporters in every consultant-led maternity unit in the UK. And because they've been going for so long, it's quite a perfected system now. There are reporters in each consultant hospital, and they are used to getting cards every month and filling out details of any rare events that UCOS happen to be looking at. So the UCOS system is reliant on cards, reliant on reporters, and visits different topics every year and prides itself very much in having very complete data. In fact, we had a 100% response rate for our study. So we feel fairly confident that we've got a good snapshot of this area in the UK.
In using obstetric units that do report to UCOS, are you saying that covers an almost 100% of obstetric units in the UK, and so your chance of there being a potential selection bias is in fact relatively small?
Oh yes, I think it covers all consultant-led units. The only caveat I would say to that would be not all the reporters are anaesthetists. So sometimes you'll have a midwife, sometimes you'll have an obstetrician who's the primary link point to the UCOS system. But we felt because of the nature of the questioning that there would be no doubt in our minds that whoever was receiving this reporting card and saying, yes, we have had a failed intubation, and then getting a further in-depth reporting card would almost certainly approach the anaesthetist for interpretation of the data. And so we feel that it would be pretty robust.
As you state in the paper, there is a wide variation in the reported incidence of failed intubation, and this is in part to do with problems estimating the number of general anaesthetics given in obstetrics. Could you briefly outline how you've generated the denominator for your figures?
Well, I actually was hoping you wouldn't ask me too much about that.
Sorry.
It's statistics isn't my strongest point. I would just go back to the more obvious way of collecting data, which we thought we would rely on before I'd launch into statistics. We thought we could look at the NOAAD database, the National Obstetric Anesthesia Database, which the OAA are responsible for. But unfortunately, we didn't have enough complete data from the same units, the consultant-led units, over that period of time to give us reliable general anaesthetic rates. There's about 53% response rate. And we weren't sure that this was going to be useful. And in fact, what we decided to do was use this unit-based estimation approach. And actually, that was the suggestion of our co-author, Malachy Cullum. And from my understanding, what he's done is we have a case coming from each hospital accompanied by two controls, and they are the two preceding general anaesthetics in that hospital. So you have we have three general anaesthetics in any given unit reporting a failed intubation. And so we looked at the time interval between those cases and then extrapolated to give an estimation over the two-year period. So it's a unit-based estimation of the incidence. And then, of course, we could extrapolate from that to the number of units and then give a rough estimate of yearly incidence. But it's not unusual, it's not uncommon to find that there are major deficits in our national statistics. And I was interested in being a part of NAP4 that we didn't even know how many general anaesthetics we gave. So obstetrics really wasn't any exception to that. And that data really isn't available. And so we felt fairly confident that the unit-based estimation approach was as good as any. So just looking at each unit, estimating the time interval between first and last case and extrapolating that. Does that make any sense to you?
That does, thank you. And as you highlight, this data just doesn't exist in a reliable format. I thought it was particularly interesting, the method you used to estimate it, and that's why I wanted to bring it up.
You can thank Malachy Cullum for that, because that was his brainchild.
Well, I think you've explained it very well there. That's quite clear. So the incidence you actually came up with was 1 in 224, which was in the right range for the generally reported incidence. But how did you find that figure, higher or lower than you were expecting?
I honestly didn't expect to find so many failed intubations. I really thought, looking back at the literature, that we would find that we would have improved. And there have been a couple of papers recently, the Jabati paper from Liverpool and then the large study from Canada, McKerra paper, that have reported no failed intubations in large numbers of patients. They speculate that's because they do quite a lot of general anaesthetics. They have quite a high general anaesthetic rate in their units. And given these recent studies, I was thinking, well, you know, that's good that they don't have any failed intubations. And although we maybe don't do so many in our units, I certainly didn't expect it to be staying in line with the rates of 15, 20 years ago. So I actually was surprised that the rate was so high.
Before we move on to the headline results, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the timings of general anaesthetics and who was giving them. You found an association between procedures occurring out of hours and a significantly greater risk of failed intubation for junior trainees anaesthetising without direct supervision.
Yes, we did. And I think that's probably very much linked to the fact that a lot of emergency surgery and it's done out of hours. It was good to see that there were never any problems in the cases in gaining expert help very quickly. And although the initial anaesthetist was a trainee, they were very quickly accompanied by a senior trainee and all of them a consultant eventually. So it didn't really surprise me because it would correspond with when you see these patients coming for general anaesthetics. A very high number of them are emergencies.
Moving on to the results, there were three major associations the study found with regard to failed intubation. Could you take us through those?
Yes, when we did the multivariate analysis, the significant independent predictors were body mass index, age, and whether a Malampati score was recorded in the notes, and also whether it was greater than or equal to one. Well, the BMI, we'll start with. We all know the rising obesity rates are causing problems across the board, but we are seeing a particularly high incidence of obesity in obstetrics. And in fact, one of the other UCOS studies was looking at obesity, recently, and they started out looking at BMIs greater than 50, and they were inundated with cases. And we now know that one in 1,000 deliveries approximately have a BMI over 50. So we have an epidemic on our hands. And of course, if that's compounded with an emergency situation and somebody that's not fasted with a baby with a poor trace, it would come as no surprise that the BMI was significant. What probably comes as more of a surprise was that the age was coming through very strongly. I'm not quite sure I can explain that. It may be more associated with the mothers with morbidity, perhaps the babies requiring emergency sections. I'm not very clear on the reason for the difference. And actually, in terms of age, although it's highly significant, I think the mean age for the cases was about 28 and the control group was about 30. So in actual fact, you're only talking about a couple of years of age difference. But because it's so significant, obviously we can't ignore that. The Mallampati score is interesting. It wasn't very well recorded, but if the anaesthetist did record the Mallampati, then it's significant. And that maybe reflects the fact that they were worried about the airway to start with, but also could reflect the fact that they might have recorded it retrospectively, particularly since it was a patient that had gone off. And also, we weren't sure of the timings of the recordings for the UCOS data entry as well. So we know a lot of people don't record Mallampati, and we know that if the Mallampati is not, if it's higher than one, that's significant. But I really don't think we've got very robust data, and we really have to start assessing our airways better, I think, and charting that too.
Talking briefly about airway examination in obstetric patients, I think it reveals something very telling, potentially, about the anaesthetic eyeball assessment, that it was the actual recording of the Mallampati score itself rather than the figure that was independently associated with failed intubation.
Yeah. Does that surprise you, Rick?
Yes. No, I think it did, without reflecting too hard on my own obstetric practice. But yes, I completely take your point that this might have been retrospectively put on the anaesthetic chart. Of course, it's very difficult to retrospectively do someone's Mallampati when you've when you're halfway through a failed intubation. But yeah, I think that's an interesting, very interesting point. There's a lot of data that you say you collected, including things like incisor gap and thyramental distance. But then that's not mentioned anywhere else in the results. Was that because it was incomplete data set, or
it was far worse. It was charted in a very poor way. The Mallampati was the most common one.
Right.
I mean, practically thinking about a general anaesthetic, you don't actually chart it until after you've finished in many occasions, because the patient's rushed down to theatre and you're talking to them, making sure the drip's working, drawing up your drugs, and it's often done afterwards. So I think that's what we meant by retrospective as well. But we looked at neck, we looked at the sternomental, we looked at thyramental, we asked about internocisor, but the data was so scanty, we didn't think it was worth putting in the paper. And there was an awful lot of information to put in the paper as well. So that's why we didn't mention it.
Do you think we can conclude, though, from the data you collected, that obstetric airway assessment probably is not done sufficiently well?
Well, it's interesting you ask, because I've been given, the answer is yes, of course, and I've been given the mandate as part of the forthcoming obstetric algorithm from DAS and OAA. I've been asked to do the assessment, it's not a chapter, it'll be a section in the guidelines, and I think we have to look carefully at developing a very rapid technique in assessing airway and remembering to do it, and we've discussed this quite a lot at the meetings we've had so far. And I think we've got out the way partly of doing it, and partly because we don't see the patients early enough, as we're not permitted on many occasions in delivery suite to enter the normal delivery patient. So we do get out the way. We don't always see patients before they arrive in theatre. We don't always get a chance to take a history and assess the airway. I would say, though, that we'll be encouraging people to look at airways, for example, when they're doing an epidural, or when they're putting in a Venflon, or taking blood, or being asked to help out at all. We must remember to look at that area, because it's well worth spending what is actually less than a minute on looking at the five golden tests, and it's something that we should be doing more often.
So what guidelines are currently available for obstetric airways?
Well, I think if you look at the OAA website, Rick, we have a lot of guidelines about failed intubation, and we have lots of algorithms from different hospitals. the difficulty with society haven't, as you know, had a specific obstetric guideline in the past, and that's something we're addressing now with the OAA. So that's it's exciting to be involved with that. And we have some from in the US. There are some papers. The ASA has got some information about obstetrics, and I think we've been looking at the Italian guideline as well. The Italian Difficult Airway Society or equivalent has looked specifically at obstetrics. But interestingly, it's been an area that people have actually avoided, I think, because it is quite complicated when you're dealing with two people. You're having to assess the urgency of the intubation, and there's lots of other factors involved, which makes it more difficult to have a clear algorithm.
So looking at the subsequent airway management in the case of failed intubation in your paper, happily, none of the cases you reported were a can't intubate, can't ventilate scenario. But what was the most commonly used rescue method?
So we discovered that the classical laryngeal mask airway was by far the most common. And that was 39 out of the 57 cases using a standard laryngeal mask airway. And I think that corresponds to how we feel. It's the most commonly used supraglottic device. And it actually provided a reasonable airway, although you don't have that information. I didn't analyse the quality of the airway. But it was obviously good enough to carry on and use to finish the case. And actually good enough for 8 cases to be carried on, even though they weren't urgent. They weren't Graves Category 1 sections. So I think that is an interesting reflection of our anaesthetic practice, the fact that we are carrying on with our anaesthesia with a device that won't protect the airway from aspiration and doesn't give us a definitive airway that we would choose to have.
So are you able to make for us a broad brush prediction on what sort of devices the DAS OAA guidelines might be looking to use?
I think we would be very foolish to consider to be recommending a practice that isn't currently done. So we'll be recommending very much to carry on with our skills and the classical laryngeal mask and supraglottic devices. But we would also be recommending that the use of ProSeal, for example, something that would give you a better seal for ventilating and have some protection from gastric aspirate. Should be definitely on that trolley and something that you're very familiar with using. There's obviously video scopes coming through as well. And I think as well as second generation supraglottics, we'll be recommending the use of video scopes. It's early data. We have the video scopes are just becoming available now in obstetrics, even more so than in general cases. They should be really good at airways because they have got patients with high risk airways. Albeit we don't see it very often, we should be feeling well equipped to deal with failed intubation. We should have a good range and we should have a good experience base on all airway devices.
For anyone undertaking obstetric anaesthesia in the UK, what are the most important take-home messages from your report?
Well, I think you've got to try your very best to assess your patient if you can, and bearing in mind the difficulties we have seeing patients before they come to theatre if they've not had an epidural or we've not visited them for an anaesthetic reason. So try to be very aware of airway. Try to assess as much as you can in your patients and try to get the people you work with aware of the need for this. And the UCOS will hopefully help take that message because it's something that's going across the board to obstetricians and midwives. The beauty of the UCOS data is it's cross-specialty. And the team should know about our difficult airways and how it's a problem, not just for the anaesthetist, it's a problem for the midwife, it's a problem for the obstetrician and the neonatologist. So I think linking in as a trainee and discussing these things, and it's very important to assess. And if you do have a problem, highlighting that with the team and highlighting that with your senior anaesthetist. Forewarned is forearmed. If you can, that's great. But obviously you can't always do that. So then the next bit is to really make sure that you have those airway skills as early as you can. Trying out difficult airways in other areas, trying to go to courses, learn about different devices and feel confident as you can. Because if you have a difficult airway in obstetrics, it really will be a challenge.
And finally, looking forward, what's the next piece of research that needs to be done in obstetric airways?
Well, I think the video scopes is something we need to look at. And that, where is the place? How early do you reach for your video scope? should units have them and what is the best one? That's going to take a while, but it is coming through. Other airway devices, perhaps, but I think what I've mentioned in the paper is our focus should be looking at obesity and the changes in obesity and trying to get a better way of assessing the impact. As we know, some obesity patients are extremely easy to intubate, but how do we better assess and predict the ones that aren't? It's a bit of a challenge, I know, but that would be the way that I would like to see things going at the moment.
Dr. Quinn, congratulations on your paper, and thank you very much for joining me on the BJA podcasts.
It's been a real pleasure, and thanks for asking me.